Hidey-ho, my fish-frying fans. This here is an ultra-special, brand-new episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. I'm your host, Amelia Dalton from eejournal.com, and this week I'm taking us off the rails. We're trading our O-scopes for tricorders. We're ditching that RTL, HLS, UVM, and I2C for JTK, baby. That's right, I said it. JTK. If you don't know what that is, well, then you probably need this interview more than most. I know what you're thinking. Wait a second, Amelia, is this just another fanciful analogy showing that Star Trek was the basis of yet another awesome invention in EE? No. Actually, we're headed to the source this week. My guest is Mark Cushman, and Mark has been working on a book for a couple decades now that will blow your mind. It's called These Are the Voyages, The True History of Star Trek, The Original Series, Season 1. More Trek than you will ever know what to do with, and I absolutely could not wait to interview Mark. So put down that register list, probe or soldering gun, and let's take a ride on the Enterprise. Oh, wait, one last thing before we get to some seriously awesome Trekkie goodness. I have a brand new nerdy giveaway to throw your way this week. It's an original Beagle Bone, courtesy of our good friends at Newark Element 14. Heck, you can enter to win one of these awesome kits for your very own right now by going to element14.com/fishfry. And more about that kit later. So, without further ado, my guest today is Mark Cushman. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, Mark, I heard your book, These Are the Voyages, The True History of Star Trek, The Original Series, Season 1, referred to as the Star Trek Bible. Give me and my audience more information about your book. What kind of awesomely Trekkie stuff will we get to learn?
Okay, well, first of all, it was Gene Roddenberry's son, Rod, who referred to it as what's going to be the Bible for the original Star Trek. He had read portions of it, and I'd interviewed him for the book as well. What's making this the Bible is, first of all, it started with Gene Roddenberry back in 1982. I was working for a company, and they dispatched me out to interview Gene for a documentary on Star Trek, a video documentary. And at that point, we only had the first series and the first movie. And Wrath of Khan, the second movie, was coming up. And the conventions were still going big every year in every city that you can imagine. It was on 100-plus stations in 50 foreign countries. So they said, well, this thing just keeps growing and growing. So I went out and interviewed Gene. Paramount fell in love with the idea of doing the special when they heard we were doing this. So they raced us to the finish line with Leonard Nimoy. It did Leonard Nimoy's Star Trek Memories. Our TV special got aborted. And that's when Gene turned to me and he said, why don't you do it as a book? And it's taken me this long. Now, to answer your question, why is it special? Well, first of all, it had Gene Roddenberry's endorsement, his cooperation. He then referred me to Robert Justman, who was his co-producer. I interviewed him. And Bob and Gene had kept all the paperwork for Star Trek, all the files, all the memos that went back and forth between these men and their writers and their directors and the network and the studio. Just boxes and boxes. As a matter of fact, I think it's something like 45 boxes. Each was maybe 1,000-plus pages in each one. And so I went through all these boxes and created this document that's going to be released in 3 volumes, which gives you these memos, bits of the memos, the ratings for the first time that have never been revealed, and they're much better than we were ever told, fan letters, censor reports from the network, just everything you can imagine that takes you back in time, allows you to watch the show being produced and watch it air for the first time.
That's really cool. So I'm really interested, Mark, about those memos by Gene Roddenberry. Tell us more about those. What cool things did you learn from them?
Oh, absolutely. The first thing that surprised me was the length of these memos that these gentlemen would write back and forth. And Gene Kuhn as well, which was the next producer that came on board for the second season. These memos sometimes for every outline that was turned in for each script. They would do an outline first, which would be maybe 10 pages long, and then a revised outline. Then they would do the script, and then a revised script, and another revised script, and on and on. For each draft of every one of these episodes. These memos would range anywhere from 5 to sometimes 25 pages in length. Gene Kuhn was notorious for writing long memos. He'd get a 60-page script, and he would dictate a 25-page memo single-spaced to Roddenberry and Justman, and they would dictate memos back. And the wonderful thing about this is I take little snippets from each one of these, a paragraph here and a paragraph there, and you get to hear the dialogue back and forth between the creative minds involved in Star Trek, what they liked about these scripts, what they were trying to do, things they had to take out because they couldn't afford to make them, a script that maybe wasn't developing as well as they had hoped, things of this nature. And so you get to hear the candid conversations in the development of the scripts. Same thing with the production notes on the set, from the production manager to be on the set, keeping notes of everything that's being filmed, what's being filmed on what days, what goes right, what goes wrong. But Roddenberry, in his memos, I was startled by how much he contributed to each episode. He would get a script or an outline, and he would start dictating and say, instead of doing this, why don't we do this? And he would just reinvent the entire story as we would later see it on the screen, as he's dictating at 10 o'clock at night, just going on and on and on. It's just pouring out of his head. You see the genius that he is in these memos.
Mark, I'm curious. I read that you managed to get your hands on the Nielsen ratings for the first time. Tell me about that. And you said they were actually better than what was reported at the time?
Boy, I got to tell you, and sorry for the long answers, but this has been such a journey. Just the Nielsen ratings took such a long time to find. I contacted AC Nielsen New York. They said they didn't have them. They said, we haven't kept any of the ratings from the 1960s. Why would we? I contacted NBC. I contacted the Academy of Television and the Museum of Broadcasting. Nobody had any ratings other than a top 10 list, which has been published in a few books. And finally, I contacted Nielsen again, I think the third time, over a course of a year. And I thought, this can't be true. And I got a hold of somebody who was a salesperson. And I asked them, and I said, I'm willing to license these things. And they said, well, they must exist because this person is going to make a commission. So they went down into the sub-basement, and they dug, and they found all the ratings. And so we have the ratings for all the episodes of Star Trek, which have never been published.
Wow.
And there's been this folklore that began by NBC, which always said Star Trek was an underachiever, and they were always trying to cancel it every year. So the folklore that's existed through the decades, four and a half decades now, is that Star Trek did not do well in the ratings. The fact of the matter is it did very well. In its first season, it quite often won its time slot against very heavy competition. On ABC, it was up against Bewitched, which was ABC's number one rated show. And Star Trek often beat it. CBS was My Three Sons, and then the start of the CBS Thursday Night Movie. My Three Sons was the 12th highest rated show on CBS, and Star Trek often beat it. And yet NBC's saying Star Trek failed. Well, this creates a bit of a mystery for me to solve then. Why would a network claim that a show was not doing well in the ratings when it was?
Right.
Why would this network keep trying to cancel a show that's doing well for it? And I dug up the answers to those questions, too. And it's a fascinating story. The politics that go on in entertainment and the things that happen aren't always about making money. A lot of times they're about somebody's ego.
Okay, so when can my audience and myself get a copy of Volume 1 and the other volumes in this set as well?
Okay, Volume 1 is scheduled for early summer. We're looking at mid-June. Now, that's not in stone with publishing. Things can sometimes get pushed back a couple weeks or even a month or two.
Sure.
But that's the target date for the publication of Volume 1. And they're going to come out 3 months apart. So hopefully you will be seeing Volume 2 in early September, and Volume 3 right around the start of December. We're trying to get all three of these books out in 2013 so you can have them all before Christmas.
Yes, I think someone in my house is getting this volume set for Christmas this year. Well, Mark, one last question for you. If there was one thing you learned in this many-year process of studying Star Trek that stands out to you, what's the coolest thing you learned?
I was shocked to find out how much the world has changed because of a TV show. Now, I did a book a few years ago on I Spy. And I picked that particular show because I knew Robert Culp, and he said he and Bill Cosby were surprised nobody had written a book because that show changed the racial barriers on TV. It broke through the racial barriers. And so in a way, it changed the world. And to follow up on that, Star Trek seemed the natural thing because I had that connection with Roddenberry, had started this book so long ago and then abandoned it because it was too much work. So I finally started it up again 6 years ago and got serious about doing it. And here's what came out of this particular show. The obvious ones, we could say, well, automatic opening doors, sensor-controlled opening doors. The guys who got the idea to do that got that from Star Trek. But the cell phone. Think about the early cell phones. They even looked like Kirk's flip-open communicator. The Bluetooth. Spock and Uhura used to have that thing they'd screw into their ear. That was the Bluetooth. McCoy's medical scanner and everything in sickbay, the guys who created the CAT scans and the MRIs, so they got their ideas from the original Star Trek. Bill Gates, with his PC and then the Internet, got this from Star Trek. He said he used to watch the show as a kid, and he wanted that computer that Spock had that could bring up all the information in the universe.
I love it.
Type it in a Word. And so all these things and more, even the CDs and DVDs, all these things were people who were kids watching this show, and then they grew up to invent these things and make them for real. So even if you don't like Star Trek, even if you never watched it, which I can't imagine, I think everybody on the planet has seen it.
I think so too.
Our lives have been impacted by a TV series, and that's why I like to write about these type of shows, because they have changed the world. TV can do that.
That's very true. I think it can. Well, that's all I have time for today, unfortunately. I'm really looking forward to reading your books, Mark. Thank you so much for spending the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes, and one last thing before this week's absolutely fantastic nerdy giveaway. You guys have just a couple more days to win 5 Amazon.com gift certificates worth $50 and 1 grand prize Amazon.com gift certificate worth $250. Just by telling us your opinions about FPGA design tools, specifically Xilinx and Altera tools. Check out the link below the player on this week's Fish Fry page on eejournal.com and let us know what you think. We're shutting this survey down pretty soon, so you might want to head on over there now. Okay, everyone, it's time for my brand new nerdy giveaway this week. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the Beagle Bone. Yes, that's right, the Beagle Bone, courtesy of our good friends at Newark Element 14. The Beagle Bone is a low-cost, high-expansion, hardware hacker-focused Beagle Board. It is a bare-bones Beagle Board that acts as a USB or Ethernet-connected expansion companion for your current Beagle Board or Beagle Board XM, and works standalone as well. The BeagleBone is small even by BeagleBoard standards, and with the high-performance ARM capabilities you'd expect from a BeagleBoard. The BeagleBone brings full-featured Linux to places it has never gone before. Some of your potential awesome designs you could create with this BeagleBone include portable navigation, connected vending machines, home building automation, consumer electronics, industrial robots, 3D printers, in-vehicle entertainment, and monitoring. So, if you want one of these awesome kits for your very own, head on over to element14.com/fishfry to enter. Go there now. You know you want to. And if you didn't know already, you should really check out EE Journal on Facebook at Facebook/EE Journal and on Twitter at EE Journal TFM. Well, that's all there is for this week's Fish Fry. Remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, specifically how you can enter to win that Beagle Bone, courtesy of Element 14, head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, yes, I will be at Design West and DAC this year, or the best geeky hotspot in your hometown, shoot me a line at amelia@techfocusmedia.com or post a comment on our forums on eejournal.com. For the week of March 29th, 2013, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.